Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for June 6, 2019, and a couple of quick topics. Last week I had just a few seconds, and I mentioned space light pollution, and this is a result of SpaceX launching a series of 60 satellites in the Starlink system. Now, that might sound like a good idea, and you have to look back and look at all of the accomplishments of SpaceX. They have done a remarkable job given a private budget, and I mentioned this before, that when SpaceX opened up its doors and said, we're hiring, every NASA engineer or engineer in other companies that were worth their salt raced to the front door to put in an application because they were tired of sitting in some, you know, decaying, molding office in an aerospace corporation that depends on government funding and top-down ideas, which are non-existent, and go to a company that was progressive, that was going to do something. So when SpaceX launched their Falcon Heavy, it was a marvelous success, did things that no other spaceship rocket had ever done before, and that was to bring the, in this case, the boosters back down to land on a pad so that they could reuse them. I've been in the rocket factories where they build the rocket tubes, basically, and they're disposable. Once they go off, they go off and land in the ocean, and they don't come back. They're not usable, so it causes a tremendous amount of expense to the launch overall expense of a launch. But SpaceX has done these remarkable engineering feats not even considered previously. And, you know, so the Falcon Heavy itself was a remarkable rocket, and not only remarkable in its performance, but the fact that they did this in record time. All of the other major aerospace corporations with their gazillions of dollars in government funding and on and on, could not pull this off with decades of work and almost unlimited government funding. So, you know, my hat's off to SpaceX and Elon Musk for running a really an amazing program. But be that as it may, a couple weeks ago, SpaceX launched a series of 60 satellites in the Starlink system, of which there are eventually going to be 12,000 of these satellites, and that means that you could have a cell phone or any type of Wi-Fi connected device, computer, laptop, tablet, you know, whatever, your whole business, whatever, and it could communicate through this Starlink system with the satellites orbiting the Earth with a never-ending chain of connections with redundancy, etc. But eventually there will be 12,000 of these satellites. And so that might be, you know, sound like a good idea. 12,000 satellites is an awfully big number, but they have a light on them that blinks. Now, and they're very bright. So I saw an article in space.com where they were praising this. And I'm like, what the heck? You know, who is in charge of this? Who's in charge of this whole program where you would put blinking lights on thousands of satellites that are in orbit around Earth? That's not a good idea. This would be the equivalent of, say, your neighbor decides they need more security or something, and so they take a blinking spotlight on their house and shine it in your bedroom window, blinking all night long. You know, it's like, wait a minute. No, this is not going to happen. You know, so the issue is that there will be 12,000 of these. And just to put this into perspective, if you go out to a remarkably clear, dry night, you go out to the desert out in the one of the most remote places on Earth. You go down to Patagonia, South America, or to the, you know, one of the deserts of the world. There's no city lights for hundreds and hundreds of miles. So it's really dark location. And you go out there to look at the night sky. Or you go up into one of the northern climates in the middle of winter on a starry night when there's no water in the atmosphere because it's too cold. It's all crystallized and fallen down. So you have this perfectly dry atmosphere to look through. And you look up at the night sky, the maximum, if you have good eyes, 20/20 vision, if you have really good eyes, you look up at the sky and there will be about 3,000 stars visible. And you go, oh my goodness, you know, the moon is not there. It's a perfectly dark sky. You can see with the best visible conditions, the best viewing conditions, you could see about 3,000 stars. Okay? Now, compare this to 12,000 blinking satellites all over the sky. Blink, 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 all of them blinking. Your view of the night sky will be completely trashed. Even if there were one of these, it would be completely trashed. Now, you can see satellites going around Earth, and typically you see this around sundown or sunrise, where the part of where you are, the down on the Earth's surface, it's dark. You've already passed the terminator line. The Earth is spun. You're in darkness. But you look up, and 100 miles up, there's still sunlight. And you see a satellite going around Earth. And, of course, you can tell the difference between those and, a jetliner that's up at 35,000 feet because the jetliner has blinking lights on it. But the satellite, you can tell that it's a satellite. But this is reflected light off the satellite, and it only lasts for a couple of minutes. But in the darkness of the night sky, you're not going to see these satellites because the Earth is blocking the light from the sun. It's reflected light. So this phenomenon of seeing a satellite crossing the night sky only occurs for a short period of time in the morning or in the night, right at sunrise and sundown. And okay, but anyway, having 12,000 satellites going around the Earth blinking, that means that at any given time, 6,000 of them would be visible. Twice as many stars are in the heavens, and they're going to be much brighter than the stars in the heavens, which are, you know, gazillions of, who knows how many light years away. But you're going to see 12,000, or at any given time, 6,000 blinking lights up there. It's going to destroy your view of the heavens. Can you imagine your nature's experience as you go out into the wilderness and look at the night sky, and you're going to see 12,000 blinking satellites whipping around? Oh my goodness, who's in charge here? There was an accord that was signed decades ago that nobody, for example, would own the moon. The moon would be available for all of mankind. Well, let me tell you something. People are already dividing up the moon and every other asteroid out there that has any wealth in it at all, of metals or whatever. They're already dividing it up and deciding who's going to go out there and get the minerals, etc., and become wealthy. So outer space is not this beautiful, tranquil place for all of mankind. No, it's being divided up just like everything else on planet Earth. And it makes you wonder, in fact, if there are truly aliens out there watching this big mess evolve, which is the people on planet Earth. I shouldn't say evolve. I don't like that word. But the social evolution, let's just put it that way, that it's pretty scary. I would be afraid of the human race if I were an alien. That's all I can tell you. I wouldn't want these people out in outer space. They've trashed this planet, which is a gorgeous, beautiful water planet full of vibrant life, and, you know, just trashed it over and over again. I mean, that's just the modern and ancient theme, is to trash it, basically. Okay, now I'm going to make a prediction here of oil on the moon. And this is something I've talked about before. I've talked about it in my writing, but I'm going to do it on this show because this is something that would be totally, absolutely unexpected according to standard science. Now, according to standard science, oil and on planet Earth and propane and natural gas and et cetera is a result of what they call fossil fuels, dinosaur bones and decaying dinosaur bones and fern forests allegedly caused the oil on Earth. Well, what a completely ridiculous concept. But at any rate, I'm going to predict that they're going to find abundant oil on the moon. And the reason is because the moon acted as a comet, it still is, and therefore, and just like Earth, we've been involved in pollution events where we've had tremendous amounts of hydrocarbons come into the upper atmosphere. The ancients talk about this, the rain of firestone, brimstone, and fire, and naphtha, naphtha being combustible hydrocarbons. That's the ancient term for hydrocarbons, what we call oil or related burnable materials. Okay, so anyway, why should there be oil on the moon? Well, it's because the moon is involved in the discharge of the solar capacitor. We have been involved in pollution events where large comets have come by. We've passed through the tail, and the water would then accumulate, and that's why the moon has rivers, very visible rivers on the surface. But yet it doesn't have the water because on the moon there's no atmosphere to keep the water in place. But my prediction, we will find tar. Now, we found tar on the surface of comet nuclei. Comet nuclei have tar, and it's more than comical to see the space scientists look at this and, you know, just pass over like, oh, no big deal. We found tar on, you know, where were the dinosaur bones and fern forests on a comet nucleus? You know, it's just absolutely absurd. When you look at standard science, it is absolutely absurd and ridiculous, the contradictions that come up every day. It couldn't possibly be true, yet it's found in all of the textbooks, etc. I just want to make another example of a prediction I made with my original work, and that is that comets would have X-rays. And the reason comets should have X-rays is because in the discharge of the solar capacitor, the electron beam that comes in from the sunward side, as it encounters the comet coma, this big vacuous atmosphere that surrounds a comet, and its Dubai shielding hydrogen cloud, ionized hydrogen, that surrounds the negatively charged comet nucleus. And by the way, comet nuclei are not simply charged because they like to be. There's a reason for them. Charges in outer space do not simply exist. And that's where, like, these the morons that run around, jump up and down, try and copy my work, have no clue because they're not physicists. They're jokesters. But they just seem to think things are charged and things move around like electrons and atoms due to charge. No, that's not how things work out there. To have a charge in outer space, it has to be produced and maintained continually by some existing energy source. Well, I'm not going to go into all the details. I talk about that in detail in my books. So the prediction of X-rays around comets is one of my main predictions. And also then finding oil on the moon, hydrocarbons, let me put it that way, on the moon. And of course, the volatile ones would have escaped a long time ago, but the heavy tars and the tars and the heavy oils, the large hydrocarbon chains would still be there. So anyway, on to the next topic. Okay, moving on. I just want to remind you, I talked about this in John Moore's show yesterday morning. There is a report that I just saw. It was on a YouTube channel. It's very good. This woman is Norwegian. She has a thick Norwegian accent, but very tuned to the politics of the world, and she does interviews. So anyway, it's called the Herland Report, and Herland is spelled H-E-R. L-A-N-D. H is in Hamlet, E is in Edward, R is in Ralph, H-E-R-L-E-N-D report. And she interviewed Robert David Steele. And I highly, highly recommend that all of you go and listen to that and listen to some of her other reports. There's one, let me see if I can quick look at the name on this one, where she interviews Joaquin Flores. And so anyway, that's a very interesting interview also about the Ukrainian situation and a lot of other world politics that may not seem to make sense. Of course, you get this Western news spin on things to make it sound like all of this, you know, revolution in a country and but they go into the behind the scenes activities of the CIA and the U.S. intelligence agencies and the White House and the players like Joe Biden's son getting a position and a lot of money when the Ukrainian deal went down. And also, for example, John Kerry's son getting head of the oil industry in the Ukraine after the so-called revolution. But anyway, very interesting to see the commentary. But once again, the name is the Herland Report, H-E-R-L-A-N-D report, and Robert David Steele and Joaquin Flores. Those are two must-listen. This is on YouTube, so just look that up. Okay, universities. I also brought this up on John Moore's show yesterday. But universities are way, way out of whack. They are bastions of very strange, I wouldn't even call it liberalism, basically bastions of bizarre thought, the bizarre political opinions. Because basically the people who are in the position, I'm not talking so much about the administration, although they cater to this also, but the professors at the university level are very cloistered. Let's put it that way. What is a cloister? A cloister, we many times think of nuns or brothers or priests or abbots or etc. that are in a closed situation where they are taught to think alike. They have one mindset. And things work well because they are all of one mindset. Universities used to be a bastion of a variety of thought, of diversity of thought, but that's not true at all today. They claim to be diverse locations for diversity, but they're not. What they do is they bring in so many black people and so many people from third world countries, etc., and they call that diversity. It's not diversity. Just because you have people of different colored skin and et cetera in your university or college does not make it diverse, because the thought is what should be diverse, and there's no diversity of thought anywhere to be found in your typical college campus. So the point I wanted to get to here is that Elizabeth Warren, apparently this lady that claims she's a Native American because her grandmother told her she was, and she's about as Scandinavian looking as you could possibly be, never grew up on an Indian reservation, has no connection with Indian tribes, has no percentage of Indian blood any more than the rest of us on the planet. But whatever, you know, I think she's just a little bit out to lunch. She has a webpage telling you how much you would be relieved of in terms of debt, in terms of student loans, if she were elected. The first thing I want to mention, she does not have control over this. This would have to be implemented through Congress. Something like that is not going to get implemented through Congress. One of the greatest debts of the United States is in student loans. The greatest debt, this may surprise you, in the United States, the greatest debt is airline reward points. If everybody went in today and tried to cash in their reward points for airlines, you couldn't do it. There's not enough. That's why they roll over. That's why their plans are set up for you to lose your points, because there's no way they can give out all those free flights. It's a way of them competing against other airlines, and it's one upmanship But there's no way they could possibly give away all of the free flights that are outstanding. It's the biggest debt in the United States. Number two is student debt for university. And so these people have gone out and gotten educations for which they can't find a job that can possibly pay that back. So what she's hoping to do is get this body of voters to vote for her because she's, you know, wants to give this away. The thing she does not have is a matching webpage to tell you how much you are going to have to pay to pay off these student loans. And the reality is in around 1970, colleges and universities realized that mom and dad had paid for their house all of these years, and they had a lot of equity in that house by the time junior and sis were ready to go to college. So they upped the price of college and university dramatically. When I went to school, my total tuition and room and board total bill for the year, it was a two-semester system, but from September to springtime, my whole tuition and room and board was $2,400. Now it's easily 10 times that. Well, what amounts to the great change? Is there any better quality service today? Is there any better quality education? The answer is no. It's just that the colleges and universities realized that mom and dad would sign up for any amount of money for junior and sis to go to college, and therefore hock the house, the family house, and so they raised the price of college and university to match, literally to match the amount of money that could be hocked by mom and dad's house, the equity in the house. Okay, so anyway, the end result is that colleges and universities have a very high-priced product that doesn't deliver. And anyway, that's something that's breaking. But anyway, enough said. But there has to be a change in the concept of college and what is taught. And if you look at the textbook industry is a giant scam. Because the approval of the colleges, etc., by some organization is another scam, keeping the monopoly there for colleges and universities that can get this so-called accreditation. In other words, all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed on paper, but then as far as educational value, hey, forget it. When I was teaching at Cornell, I criticized professors there that I was working with, and it was a very unpopular thing to do. I criticized some of the professors, the staff at Cornell, because they did not have a good product. And so anyway, I could go on and on about that. But they did not, especially for undergraduates, they did not have a good, solid product. Not the kind of education I got, not the individualized education I got when I went to college. When I went to college, my math classes, once I got into the upper specialized classes, I had a double major, math and physics. My math classes possibly had 20 students in them, some of them five. When you got to more esoteric classes like George Cantor's book on infinities or, let's say, mathematical analysis, there were smaller groups. But my physics class had 9 students. When we started, when I was a freshman, there were 42 signed up physics majors who went there, and they were going to go to try and be go through a PhD program. So it started out first semester, freshman year, 42 students in my class of physics like 101, and by the end of the semester there were 9 left. And I was at the top of my class, but those 9 students were the ones who finished 4 years later. All of the other ones were flushed out in the first semester. And so my class had sometimes, some of the classes I was taking had less than 9 students in it. Some of them, as we got up into more advanced classes, had 5 students. I took a physical chemistry course where I was the only student. It was an honors level physical chemistry course given out of the chemistry department, But I was the only student in the class. So I'd go up to the professor's office. We'd sit down and talk. I worked on projects and dealing with the rates of reaction, physical chemistry, one of the common topics, etc. Wrote some papers and then got my grade. But I was the only student. Where are you going to find that today and at that kind of price? So anyway, so just something on university. If you're out there and your kids are getting ready to go to university or college, something like that, here is my personal suggestion when people, kids get out of high school. Send them to a third world country. Literally, I'm serious. With a one-way ticket and say, okay, when you earn your way back from that third world country, then we'll talk about other things. Okay, so then the kids come back. Then what I would suggest is that they start a business. In fact, somewhere early in high school, kids should be starting an internet business of some kind to learn business acumen, how the things work, because the internet is the future of business. So I would recommend that kids take the initiative, get away from the video games, start doing something real. Where's your interest? Be creative. Do your interest. If you're interested in music or art or computer security, whatever it is, go into that and start a business on the internet. Just get smart about business. Doesn't matter if you make a lot of money or not. But if you look at the people that are successful, Steve Jobs, hate to say it, but Bill Gates, all those people, they dropped out of college to start their businesses. They became business smart on their own. And then when they went back to college, they went back to basically they could pay their own way to college. And then at that point, college is almost a moot point because typically colleges do not educate you for the future. Okay, so enough about that. Just a quick note on the election. I was talked about this last week. I was contacted by a group doing a study on some of the election fraud that occurred both in the 2016 election and the 2018. These are the federal national elections. But it got me thinking about this whole process. We're heading into another big election coming up in 2020. And there's all of this discussion about Russian interference in the election. They spent a total of like $35,000 on some Facebook ads that nobody saw, targeted at kids. That's what the Russian interference was. The real interference in the last two elections was at the local precinct level, where people literally changed the votes. They actually changed votes at the precinct level, and there's basically 10 cheating centers, major cheating centers in the United States. I talked about that in my white paper. But going back to paper voting, where there's a registered paper vote for every vote that can be counted. Well, that's not a simple solution, because in the 2016 presidential election, when they did the Jill Stein recount, In Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, what they found just in Detroit, there was over 900 precincts that they could not recount because the ballot boxes had been opened. The seal tape, there's a special sealing tape that goes on the ballot box that destroys the box if you take it off. Over 900 precincts in Detroit alone, also this happened in Milwaukee, could not be recounted because the boxes, the seals had been broken. So election fraud is rampant in the United States, but it's at the local precinct level. That's the biggie. That's the big one. And I'm coaching these people on how to determine that, do statistical samplings, etc., on how to determine where the voter fraud was occurring. Just a quick note on... There was another meeting this week about people going to Mars. Let me see if I can pull this up. Let me see. Let me quick pull this up. Here we are, Mars. Mars Explorers, this is on space.com, which is a trashy This is like the USA Today of space. Let's put it that way. Completely controlled stories. But anyway, this story, it says, a Mars explorers will tackle radiation, depression, and space bread. Now, these people are going around having meetings. A couple of weeks ago, there was one, man to Mars, or humans to Mars, something like that. So these people form a panel, and they get a little peanut gallery out there, and they film this. They get some, you know, people from NASA, and then they have artists' conceptions of people walking around on Mars with little backpacks, and they're just like they're going on a hike. You know, I talked about this before, and I'll just summarize it by saying, there ain't nobody going to Mars. You know, this is a panel of five women, and it could be five men, with doctors and ex-astronauts, etc., all sitting around smiling. But once again, there's nobody going to Mars. When you do technological steps, let's put it that way, you do one thing, and then you do another thing that's an advancement on that. Then you do another thing, then you do another thing that builds on that. NASA has never had a gravity, artificial gravity spacecraft. For example, when you get to Mars, the gravity is going to be much less than Earth. When you're traveling, you're going to be gravitationless for a period of many years, something that nobody has ever done before. You have to take all of your food, all of your water, all of the air, all of the fuel, all of the repair equipment so that if something happens, you can repair the spacecraft. Because in the radiation environment of outer space, the spacecraft parts, the seals, rubberized seals, you got to take all of this stuff. It's like, say you went, this is the difference. We've all gone camping, or hopefully most of us have gone camping. And you go out for a weekend, or maybe you rough it, you go into a wilderness area for a week, or maybe 2 weeks. I used to spend months in the wilderness by myself with no food. I would be eating the wild plants and catching fish, and that's what I lived on. And I knew how to live like that because I knew the area, how to be safe, and I would be by myself. It was a very good exercise mentally and spiritually, but anyway, getting back to this idea of going to Mars. So here maybe you're very good at hiking and going out into the wilderness and having all your camp stuff in order and all your food, etc., and maybe you eat some wild berries. But imagine going to a place in a spacecraft where you need all of the stuff that you're going to have for a 3-year period. Not only that, but everything has to work mechanically. You're not just setting up a tent at night. You're living in a spacecraft that's being bombarded by radiation on a continual basis. And you're also in exposed to radiation that is caused by discharges. Now, this is something that I went to a scientific meeting one time, and there were some NASA scientists there discussing a experiment they did. They took some barium powder, basically, ground up barium, and they put it out into outer space, and they wanted to see what this would do. Okay, so they set it out there, and what do they see? They see immediately electron cloud building up on one side of it, and they're going, what on earth is this all about? Well, what it was doing was discharging the local capacitor, and that's the characteristic of the plasma discharge comet model. Everything down to a grain of dust is discharging the local capacitor, and all the way up to planet size, up to Jupiter, discharging the solar capacitor. Or in the case if you're around Earth, which these scientists with their experiment was near Earth, out in outer space, then there would be local electric fields, which I talk about in my weather book. I define 17 of them. Local electrical batteries in outer space, they're plasma batteries that are naturally occurring due to physical phenomena in outer space. Okay, so you get into one of these plasma batteries and your whatever it is, in this case barium dust, is discharging that local capacitor, and you get the electrons on one side as part of the discharge. Okay, so anyway, the spacecraft going to Mars is going to be very much affected by discharging the solar capacitor. So if there's a flare, if there's a local capacitor, which will occur, say they are going to Mars and Jupiter is outbound from them, which it will be sometime during their existence out there. They will be crossing through the electron beam that goes out to Jupiter, because Jupiter is discharging the solar capacitor, and likewise to Mars, and likewise to Saturn even. They will be crossing through these plasma sheets, and when they do, they're going to have accelerated radiation, because the electrons, when they hit the spacecraft, are going to cause X-rays. And so these people that are going to Mars, they go, well, we'll stop radiation by having water. We're going to have a water insulator around the spacecraft, and therefore we're going to be able to protect from radiation. Well, boys and girls, let's bring some of the adults back in the room here and discuss this. No, you're not going to stop X-ray radiation with a pool, a 6-inch layer of water. Excuse me, it's not going to happen. You are not going to stop relativistic protons with 6 inches of water. What they're talking about here is just Looney Tune. It's like a cartoon. It's like Mickey Mouse playing Flash Gordon and going to Mars and landing there and having adventures and walking in caves and going on hikes on the Martian landing, so on the surface of Mars. You know, Mars is a much more hostile environment than the moon because they have dust storms. There's enough atmosphere there where they have horrendous dust storms, much worse than any dust storm on Earth. If you're familiar with dust storms, like on, say, the Sahara Desert, I was talking about desertification. You know, when you have a dust storm from the Sahara Desert or the Gobi Desert or the Chinese deserts or whatever, once you these are like sandblasting. You know, when you with the old wooden houses, somebody had come in to repaint the house and you had 10 layers of paint on there, you had to get that paint off. You can't put new paint on 10 layers of paint. So they'd come along with a sandblaster, take it down to the wood, get the paint off of there, and then paint the house on the bare wood. So that's what sand does. And it's very destructive, but on Earth, the velocity, the speed, of the sand is limited by the atmosphere. So it might be, a 50, 80-mile-an-hour wind with a sandstorm. Well, that'll take the paint off of anything. But you go to Mars and you have 300-400-mile-an-hour winds with sand blowing. let me tell you, buddy, it's going to take more than the paint off. That's going to take the surface metal off and everything else. So anyway, plus you're going to be buried under 5 feet of this when the thing is all over. I don't know what these people are thinking, but they keep having these panel discussions and they're around, oh, it's going to be so lovely when we go to Mars. Well, first of all, like I said, you would have to go to the moon first, establish your equipment, because the moon is not very far away. The moon is a couple days away in terms of travel. Mars goes around the sun, and only within a short window of time, once you get to Mars, okay, now you land, it's moving ahead, so you're not going to be able to get back to Earth for about 3 years from the point you land on Mars. 3 years, you need all of your stuff. And as I was joking on the John Moore Show, I had a little discussion about this. You're not going to have a potato farm like Matt Damon. This is not going to happen. So, the idea that somehow people are going to be in this weightless, confined environment for a period of years, which nobody has ever done before, even in Earth low orbit. Nobody has been up there in weightlessness for that length of time. the people that do come back after, say, a year, or some of them longer. I saw an interview of an astronaut, a U.S. astronaut, who said he came back to Earth. He couldn't walk. His bones were fragile. He had to lay in a bed. He could not eat. When you're without gravity, your muscles lose their tone, their ability to work. You have 600 muscles in your body. You have about 20 big ones and about 580 little muscles. All those muscles atrophy. You know, your digestive system doesn't work the same. Everything is out of kilter. Your sleep cycle is completely messed around. Talk about jet lag. Go up into space for 12 months and come back. Now you got, that's jet lag. That's serious jet lag. That's, we're going to put a new name on it, spacecraft lag or something. But no, the point is, let me just simplify this for the people that have panels and they, you know, the man to Mars and people are putting money this and asking governments to fund this. There ain't nobody going to Mars, okay? And for all practical purposes, I can tell you too that there ain't nobody going to the moon. Okay, so let's just be clear about this. You don't just put somebody in a spacecraft, send them around the moon, and bring them back. There's a lot more involved. And even that's a few-day trip. But I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. By the way, just to mention here, I was asked, and I don't know if this guy was a plant or what, on a couple of radio shows, they ask me if I'm going to have some kind of special show or some kind of activity because of the 50th anniversary of the alleged Apollo alleged landing on the moon. And no, I'm not. I'm not going to have anything relative to that at all. I have a statement on my webpage. It's just that I've advised all of you to go out and go to the sporting goods store, buy the hip boots, the biggest ones you can find that come all the way up to the neck, because of the BS you're going to have to wade through continuously as this day comes and goes. But other than that, no, I don't. I'm very busy with what I'm doing, very busy with the wing generator, etc. I'm so busy that I can't keep up with it. And I'll just make a mention here also. The amount of baloney that's being thrown at me from, it's just coming, and I know where it's coming from. But be that as it may, along with all of the good stuff going along with the wing generator, it's the baloney is coming fast and furious. That's the best term I could use to describe it. That the, just unbelievable. And, of course, I've been around the block a few times in my life, so I'll just leave it at that. But just a quick comment on Ireland and Scotland, as the as it appears England is going to elect a Brexit party, which is pretty much in the majority in England. There's just some business interests that want to stay hooked to the European Union. And, of course, the bankers want that because they control everything. But it's very interesting. England was the world power before, and now they are a minor element of the European Union over which they have absolutely no controls, run out of some other European city that, you know, so they want to get out of that thing. But interestingly enough, Ireland and Scotland are leaving England. So the belief is that within a very short amount of time, England will lose Scotland and Ireland, and those will become independent countries. And Ireland is quite the economic power of its own right. Remember that Ireland had the shipbuilding business. They built the Titanic, the sister ship. They built shipbuilding, and that was in their blood because I'm from Ireland, as you may have guessed, my ancestors, but it's an interesting history because my real ancestors are Nordic. the Vikings came and populated the British Isles up there, Northern Ireland and the west coast of Ireland, and that's where my ancestors come from, and a lot of Irish ancestors. There's the other population of England and Ireland that came through from the mainland of Europe, came through in that direction. And so there's different elements of Ireland. But my ancestors were Nordic, and of course, that's probably where I get my very bad attitude from my Viking ancestors. Well, who knows? But anyway, that's interesting. But as, you know, the normal evolution, if you look back in history, the normal evolution of city-states and then combined city-states with alliances and then growing up into countries and country-states and, you know, a king, when there was an invasion, then you needed a king, a central figure that came along and brought the people together and defended the whole realm. And then they grew up. And then after World War II, you had the United Nations, the League of Nations, United Nations, etc., growing. But then what happens is that the centralized power becomes too powerful. They assume too much power. And then the individual states start to break away once again because they've lost their autonomy. And this is going on right now in Canada. Saskatchewan, Alberta want out. They don't want anything to do with Canada. They have the bulk of the resources of Canada in terms of food, uranium, oil, everything else that Canada depends on. But they're being run like pauper states from afar, from the big cities, because in Canada, the majority of people live in the three big eastern cities and then out on the west coast in Vancouver, British Columbia. So anyway, it's a natural evolution, devolution, whatever you want to call it, that's taking place. And right now, the trend is in people breaking away, wanting their own city-state, so to speak. And by the way, I've said this a long time ago, that Minnesota, you know, we think of Texas breaking away or becoming independent, or sometimes there's talk about other states becoming independent. But Minnesota is the state that should be most likely to break away from the rest of the pack in the United States because, number one, they share a border with Canada, not only a border, an international border, but they share a water border with Canada. Minnesota has two international seaports, even though it's the centralmost state in the North American continent. If you put a pin in the middle of North America and balanced it, it would be in Minnesota. But Minnesota has two international seaports, Duluth and then Superior in its adjacent state, Wisconsin, and then the Mississippi River, which goes out to the Gulf of Mexico. So Minnesota has two international seaports. It has a border with Canada. They get 95% of their oil from Canada, and they're autonomous. They have grow their own food, basically. They don't have to import food from other places. And anyway, but they could be very easily set apart as an autonomous country. Probably the most easily separated state in, you know, not to have any effect on the local population, simply divide off and that's the end of it. Okay, well, anyway, the devolution of, I'm not recommending that, I'm just saying as a matter of economics, Minnesota would be the easiest state to break off. Even though Hawaii and Alaska are separate, they would be very difficult to break apart because of the economic conditions, which allow them to be independent. Although there are a lot of people in Hawaii who would like to be independent, it's a case where if you look at the South Pacific Islands, there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot in Hawaii. There's a lot of poverty when you get out of the main metropolitan areas, but it's certainly bolstered by its association with the main part of the United States. But anyway, those are other political issues. There are, of course, is some serious bad blood in Hawaii because of the way it was railroaded into becoming a state. So anyway, switching topics, it's kind of an evolution type of topic. I want to talk about evolution And what is wrong with evolution? Now, when a so-called science fact is repeated and repeated, it becomes believable. And the question is, well, how did things on Earth come to be? We know that there were mass extinctions back to the point where there were just amoebas, one-celled living little beings on Earth. That's how devastating some of the mass extinctions were in the history of the world. Some of them were not so bad. The most recent one, the Venus event, which was a large comet coming by Earth that eventually became the planet Venus, was pretty devastating, but it and there were mass extinctions, the mastodons, the saber-toothed tigers, you know, that crew of animals are no longer here. So there was a mass extinction at the Holocene boundary. But be that as it may, then, you know, so you could make a case or try to make a case for evolution while everything's evolving. And but there's a lot of unsolved problems here. When you start imagining that you start with amoebas and you end up with people walking around voting for, you know, presidential elections with differing opinions of political, you know, philosophy, etc. But the issue is very simple, that evolution of itself, or if you want to take Darwin's, you know, adaption and survival of the fittest or other aspects of evolution, they do not explain what we see. And here's the reason, because we see a lot of intelligence in the selection process. If this were all random, now statistics, probability and statistics is something I happen to know quite a bit about, probably a lot more than the average guy on the street, and probably a lot more than a lot of people who are college or grad school educated. Statistics, when it is applied to scientific topics, is a very interesting topic because there's a book, How to Lie with Statistics. It was in the 1960s. It possibly is still around, but it was a way of, it was a book telling about how politicians would take statistics and twist them around and then lie with them. So a very interesting book. But statistics are used to lie about evolution. And anyway, the reality of statistics, however, if you take a... Now, the last thing I'll say about evolution is it's supposedly a random process. They can't tell you what the process of evolution is. It's pretty sketchy. Let me retract that. It's not pretty sketchy. It's really, really, really sketchy how this whole evolutionary process works. They show a picture of an ape, and then he walks a little more upright, and then with his knuckles, and then all of a sudden you got people walking. You know, that famous picture of an ape, you know, turning, walking into, and then at the end of the line is the human in supposedly the evolutionary chain. That's not how statistics work. That's not how random things work. I was just dealing with a problem the other day. I remember last few weeks I was talking about population growth, and one of the very interesting things when you deal with populations is that the number of men and women, females, males, is about equal. And of course, talking about biological male and female, it's about 50-50. And so, wait a minute, how does that happen in a random biological process? How does it turn out that if you look on the local city level, if you look on the small group level, say a church, if you look on a county level, state level, federal level, world level, no matter how you break it down, it's about 50-50. And it, you know, it goes a little one way or goes a little the other way. And so that's very similar to flipping a coin. In other words, it's a random process. It's a 50-50 process. And it's designed, that 50-50 process, like flipping a coin, is to the biological genetics, male or female, in the birth, is the equivalent of flipping a coin. And that's exactly what happens when you flip a coin. If you flip a coin 10 times, say that birth, the boy or girl would be based on flipping a coin. And you flip the coin 10 times, there were 10 births. And the flipping of the coin would determine whether it was a boy or a girl. And there's a possibility that you could have 10 births, all boys or all girls, and none of the other. But typically, you wouldn't have that. If you did it 100 times, you would get closer to 50-50. If you did flip the coin 1,000 times, you would get closer to 50-50. If you flipped the coin 1,000,000 times, you would even get a narrower band, very close to 50-50. So the process of birthing and how the child is determined at birth, whether it's female or male, whether it has a Y chromosome or not, is a 50-50 process. And you can tell that in reverse by looking at the statistics, so that it's a 50-50 process. And that's very interesting, because what if it was completely random? Completely random. Then you would not have 50-50. You would have 12%, 78%, or some odd number like that if it were totally random. So what this shows us is that there is a design in that little aspect of genetic, strains for the human beings and also for other animals, that it's a 50-50 process. It's like flipping a coin. If it were different, then your coin would be different each time if it were totally random. Sometimes you would have an 87-faced coin, and there would be one chance of being female and 86 chances of being male. That would be a random process. That's what they're talking about in evolution. So it's just one simple example to show that evolution does not explain what we see in nature. I want to go into this topic a bit more, that evolution does not explain what we are seeing. Well, just simply, yeah, it's not explaining what we see in nature. Just to remind you, I'm out of time here, 20 seconds left. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. The water filters are on sale. A lot of people buying my water filters now because they're the only ones that do not need add-on filters for fluoride and arsenic. And mine take out the most bad things, volatile chemicals, heavy metals, etc., within the filter itself. You don't have to have add-ons. My filters fit all of the different canisters that are out there. Plus, I have the whole house filters and then my books, etc., and also the signing up for the wing generator on the front page, plus my paid cast. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.